This podcast was recorded at the 2015 JADPRO Live APSHO Conference. The title of the session is Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer Immunotherapy. It is presented by Suzanne Walker, CRNP, MSN, AOCN, BC, Abramson Cancer Center. To view the presentation slides or to claim continuing educational credit for this activity, please visit www.advancedpractitioner.com/JADPRO Live 2015. Now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
Hi, everyone. Welcome this morning. I'm so glad to see everybody bright-eyed, bushy-tailed at 8 a.m. this morning. I came in from the East Coast. I'm a little bit off this morning. I came in yesterday, late in the day, and I'm still on that East Coast time, trying to get started. So just a little bit of my background. I'm a nurse practitioner, and I've been working in thoracic oncology for almost the past 20 years. And in that period of time, I've seen a tremendous amount of changes in the way we're managing our patients. And it's really exciting nowadays to see just a newer class of drug, our immunotherapy drug. I also teach at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing in our oncology minor. And I have a colleague, actually, who teaches with me, who's here today, that I just ran into, Ann Markham. Raise your hand, Ann. And I just started a PhD program at the University of Arizona. So I was out in Tucson in August, and it was 107 degrees. So it's so nice to be here today when the temperature's a little bit more, temperate, you would call it. So that's a little bit on my background. And today we're going to talk about immunotherapy and how it relates to non-small cell lung cancer. Just a brief overview of lung cancer. There are about 200,000 cases expected for 2015, and it's the leading cause of cancer death in both men and women, and accounts for more than a quarter of all cancer deaths. I think a lot of people don't realize that it has a higher mortality than breast, prostate, and colorectal cancers combined. And the five-year survival is about 20%, and that hasn't changed. It's actually a little less than 20%, and that hasn't really changed significantly since I've been doing lung cancer work. But I'm hopeful that with some of our emerging targeted therapies and our immunotherapy agents, we'll definitely see an increase in that survival the next time the statistics are reported out. Most of our cases occur at an advanced stage, unfortunately. So more than 50% occur when patients have presented with metastatic disease, and about almost a quarter with regional spread. So that's why our systemic therapies are so important in this disease. Just a quick overview on the types of lung cancer. I'm sure you're all familiar. Small cell lung cancer represents a little less than 15% of cases, and then what we're going to talk about today is non-small cell lung cancer, which represents about 87% of cases. We really think about non-small cell lung cancer as squamous and non-squamous. And non-squamous would consist of adenocarcinoma and large cell, because some of our treatments vary depending upon type of histology. And I was asked to include this slide just so we could meet the objectives, but when I first started working in lung cancer almost 20 years ago, we had chemotherapy only, and we only had a couple of agents at our disposal. And chemotherapy, as you know, impacts all rapidly dividing cells, so we see those commensurate toxicities. And then our targeted therapies have emerged, and those are focusing on individual molecular targets. And now we have our immunotherapy drugs, which work on specific receptors to modulate immune system function. Okay, and I stole this slide from my collaborating physician, Dr. Evan Alley, so I will give a shout-out to Evan. Because I really liked how the gas pedal and brake analogy was illustrated here. So basically, we can think of the immune system as providing stimulatory signals, or which would be stepping on the gas pedal, or removing those inhibitory signals by lifting off the brake. Today, we're going to really be focusing on a couple of those aspects of the immune system that are really pertinent to some of the FDA-approved drugs that we have at our disposal. And you may have all heard of PD-1 and PD-L1. And when we first started conducting some of the clinical trials in our practice, I kept getting confused. What's PD-1, PD-L1? Aren't they the same thing? Well, they're a little bit different, and I'll verbally explain them, and then I have a little illustrative slide, a couple of slides down the line.
But PD-1 is programmed cell death protein, and it's an immunosuppressive molecule that's expressed on many T cells. And it's activated when it binds to its ligand, PD-L1, which, as you'll see in the next slide, is expressed on some cancer cells. And when those two areas bind, there's an impairment in T cell function. Okay, and PD-L1 is the programmed cell death ligand 1 that binds to and activates PD-1 that we just talked about. And it is expressed on many cancer cells, including lung cancer cells. And so why is T cell immunity so important? Well, just a little refresher in that the T lymphocytes are produced in the hematopoietic system, and then they mature in the thymus. And they're an important component of cell-mediated immunity. It's important to note that they do rely on these antigen-presenting cells in order to recognize the foreign object. And a lot of those would be dendritic cells. You probably have heard of those. And those are the primary antigen-presenting cells that we think of. T lymphocytes have several mechanisms of action. They can be directly cytotoxic, or they can recruit or secrete cytokines that can also recruit other immune system cells, and they can also facilitate B-cell activity. And this is that illustration that I had alluded to earlier. So I wanted to point out here there are kind of two phases that we think of. We think of a priming phase where the antigen-presenting cell presents to the T-cell, and then our effector phase here where we have the T-cell connecting with the cancer cell. And it's in this area here that everybody's familiar with ipilimumab. So ipilimumab works on the CTLA-4 connection here. And so it's a little bit less specific, which is why we can see a lot more side effects with ipilimumab than with some of our newer agents, our anti-PD-1 agents, like nivolumab and pembrolizumab, who work over here on this section. The two drugs that I just alluded to, the ipilimumab or nivolumab and pembrolizumab, work on PD-1 here to prevent that binding to PD-L1. So basically, so this here is CTLA-4, and that's what ipilimumab works on. Okay, so it works on where that antigen-presenting cell hooks up with the T cell. So it's a little less specific. And then over here is where PD-1, where nivolumab and pembrolizumab work to prevent that binding here. So I wanted to move forward, now that we have an understanding of how some of these agents work, on what those agents are. And we'll talk a little bit about pembrolizumab, and I've actually had to change these slides in the last couple of weeks several times because there have been some changes in FDA approvals. So pembrolizumab was actually just FDA approved within the last few weeks for use in non-small cell lung cancer. And it's a monoclonal antibody, and it inhibits the interaction between PD-1 and its ligands PD-L1, and there's another one called PD-L2, which we really didn't talk about today. I've included the FDA-approved indication, and I really wanted to point out here that it's FDA-approved in patients who have failed a frontline platinum-containing agent and also have overexpressed PD-L1, and there's a companion test that has been FDA-approved along with pembrolizumab, or Keytruda is the FDA-labeled name. And so we'll talk about, in another slide, about the significance of PD-L1 testing. Okay, and a lot of the data that we have comes from the KEYNOTE-1 trial, which was a phase 1b study, and it looked at almost 500 patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer, and it also looked at PD-L1 expression, which is why it's got its FDA approval in conjunction with the PD-L1 assay. Most of the patients had squamous cell, but about 20% almost had non-squamous, and most patients had had prior therapy. The median overall survival was about 12 months, which is pretty significant when you're thinking of second, third line setting. The FDA-approved dosing for pembrolizumab is 2 milligrams per kilogram, but right now in some of our clinical trials, we're looking at a fixed 200 milligram dose. It's nice because it's a 30-minute infusion and it's only administered every 3 weeks. We'll talk a little bit about the immune-related side effects a little bit later, but some of the other side effects that were noted were fatigue, some pruritus, and a reduction in appetite. Nivolumab was FDA-approved in March for squamous cell histology, but in the last couple of weeks, it got its
approval for non-squamous patients as well. And it's similar to pembrolizumab in that it's a monoclonal antibody directed against PD-1, so to prevent that connection between PD-1 and PD-L1. And it's now FDA approved, and I had to change this slide, and I don't think I had a chance to update it, for squamous and non-squamous patients. And unlike pembrolizumab, it was not FDA approved with a companion PD-L1 test. So patients don't have to express PD-L1 in order to be eligible for nivolumab. Okay. And there were two studies that were important in getting nivolumab or Opdivo, its FDA approval, and the first one is CheckMate 17, and this was a study looking at nivolumab compared to docetaxel, which is really our standard second-line chemotherapy drug, and there was a significant improvement in overall survival, but more importantly, the toxicity was much less than what we would see with docetaxel. And CheckMate 57 was important because it included non-squamous patients, and once again, improvement in survival. And I do want to point out that, you know, these survival rates might not sound huge, but patients who respond can have really durable responses, and we still haven't reached the peak of what those responses are. So in the melanoma literature, up to 20% of patients who have responded to immunotherapy may survive 10 years and more. So the non-small cell lung cancer literature is much less mature, but hopefully we'll see those, continue to see some of those durable responses, which you're not going to see with chemotherapy. So nivolumab dosing, it's 3 mg per kg over 60 minutes every 2 weeks, and other than the immune-related side effects, very well tolerated, fatigue, reduction in appetite, and some asthenia. So I mentioned earlier that PD-L1 status can be important, particularly if you want to start your patient on pembrolizumab. It's a little bit controversial right now because some studies have shown that there can be improved response rates and survival in patients who are PD-L1 positive, and some studies haven't. So we're still trying to struggle in our practices to what we're doing. The problem is you do need tissue for PD-L1 testing, and so sometimes patients don't have extra tissue. There can also be heterogeneity in the tumor, meaning that you may sample one part of it and the person may be negative, and then you may sample another part and they might be positive. So I think the utility is still to be determined. Another important point is that even patients who aren't PD-L1 positive can still respond. So I have a patient right now in my practice who was being evaluated for a chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab trial, and she was PD-L1 negative and was ineligible, and went on to receive standard chemotherapy, failed that, wasn't interested in more chemotherapy, so she started nivolumab, and she responded. So do you really want to eliminate that group of patients that may still respond? So we're still trying to figure it out. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the terminology pseudoprogression. But for those of you who aren't, it's a very important point to keep in mind when we're looking at patients responding to immunotherapy. Because pseudoprogression is when it looks like somebody's progressing radiographically, but in reality they're not. So the imaging studies may show new lesions, enlarging lesions, or inflammatory infiltrates. And it's important to repeat a scan at least 4 weeks later to confirm that the person is indeed progressing, because you may see a reduction or a resolution in those lesions. And I actually just have a patient now, a few weeks ago, had her reimaging study, and it looked like she was progressing, but she was clinically stable, so we kept going, and then about 4 to 6 weeks later, we repeated, and all of those areas had significantly improved. So we know that usually patients aren't going to respond for at least 2 months, so it's important to be careful as to when you're scanning patients, and a lot of times we don't scan until at least 2 to 3 months later unless they appear to be clinically progressing. There are some new criteria that are being utilized in some clinical trials to kind of account for this pseudoprogression, and that's the immune-related response criteria, the IIRC. Some of our future directions, we're looking at immunotherapy in the adjuvant setting, and in melanoma, just in the last couple of weeks,
Ipilimumab was FDA approved for adjuvant therapy. So perhaps down the line we'll see the same thing in non-small cell lung cancer. We're looking at it in oligometastatic disease. We have a study at our center right now. Small cell lung cancer, we're also combining it with chemotherapy and radiation and in combination with other immunotherapy and targeted agents, particularly ipilimumab, because if you think back to that picture that I showed you where ipilimumab works on that CTLA-4 area, so kind of having a double blockade may improve, hopefully, response rates and survival. Okay, so let's talk about some of the immune-mediated side effects that I mentioned earlier. And these would be our pneumonitis, colitis, nephritis, endocrine dysfunction, primarily hypo or hyperthyroidism, hepatitis. Okay, so the rates of these immune-mediated side effects are actually very low. So most of them are single digits, around the region of 1 to 5%. But it's still something to be aware of. And for those of you who are already aware, I think it's also important to make sure that non-oncology providers are aware. So when patients present to the emergency room, are the emergency room providers going to know what to look for and how to manage these symptoms? And Bristol-Myers has a great, for Opdivo or Nivolumab, like a little wallet card that patients can keep with them. So if they end up in the emergency room or at another provider's office, the side effects and how to manage them are included. So for pneumonitis, particularly in lung cancer, sometimes the symptoms can mimic some of the symptoms that patients with lung cancer have. So the median onset is about 2 to 5 months. So if you look at any of these immune-mediated side effects, the timing can really be variable. So sometimes in the first couple of months, but there have been some side effects that have been out even 12 months. So they really can occur at any time. Many of them are reversible, including pneumonitis. So if we can intervene early, then it can be reversible. So management, a lot of times it depends on the grade. So for grade 2, you would want to hold therapy and start corticosteroids. And obviously if it's grade 3 or grade 4, whereas grade 3 is requiring oxygen, grade 2 would be sort of some symptoms but able to still function, and grade 1 is asymptomatic. Colitis, we saw much more frequently with our CTLA-4 drugs like ipilimumab, and the rates appear to be pretty low with nivolumab and pembrolizumab, only about 1 to 2%. And once again, the onset can be variable. And some of the recommendations really depend on the significance. So grade 1 would be really an increase of about 4 stools per day, and grade 2 and 3 would be like IV fluids, and 4 would be hospitalization. So usually for grade 1, we can kind of keep going and symptomatically manage them, but once you start getting into grade 2 and further, then we want to hold treatment and start steroids. Nephritis or renal dysfunction can occur, so it's important to monitor labs. And when we monitor labs, it's really kind of still up in the air as to whether we do it with each round or every other, or just periodic management. So you can read some of these recommendations here. A lot of them include corticosteroids and either a 0.5 to 1 mg/kg per day or 1 to 2 mg/kg per day, depending upon the severity. Thyroid dysfunction, and a lot of our patients are already hypothyroid, occurs more commonly with hypothyroidism than hyperthyroidism. I actually have not, I don't think, had a patient yet with hyperthyroidism, but I have had a few patients with mild progression of their hypothyroidism. And a lot of times we can just manage medically with adjusting their dose of Synthroid or whatever they're taking. I haven't seen any severe cases, but in severe cases, obviously, you would hold. Hepatitis, I have a patient right now who had elevated transaminases up to almost 3 times the upper limit of normal, which would be 3 times up of the limit of normal would be about a grade 2. So you would want to hold and administer corticosteroids. And a week later, we retested her LFTs, and they had come back down to almost normal again. And so a lot of times you could resume therapy. Okay, so we're going to move into our cases. The first case is AB, who's a 55-year-old male with a history of stage 3A squamous cell non-small cell lung cancer.
Initially treated with concurrent chemoradiotherapy with weekly Taxol and carboplatin. And then after 3 months, he developed new pulmonary metastases. So the first audience response question would be, what is the best treatment option for AB at this point? A, docetaxel, which is JL192. B, nivolumab, JL193. C, erlotinib, JL194. Or D, gemcitabine, JL195. So most people pick nivolumab. That typically would be what we would do. You could consider second-line chemotherapy, but I think we know that what some of those limitations are. And based on the Brammer study that compared nivolumab to docetaxel in the second-line setting, we know that this is a better choice and there's less toxicity. So we start AB with nivolumab, and after the fourth cycle, he presents with complaints of diarrhea 2 to 3 times a day for the past 3 days. Next question. What would you recommend for AB at this point? A, continue nivolumab and add an anti-diarrheal agent such as loperamide, JL196. B, continue nivolumab and add prednisone, 0.5 to 1 mg/kg, JL197. C, hold nivolumab and add prednisone, 0.5 mg/kg, JL198. Or D, hold nivolumab and add prednisone 1 to 2 mg/kg, JL199. I feel like we should have some Jeopardy music up here. Okay, so it looks like we have a smattering of answers. Continue nivolumab. We're still tallying them a little bit. Looks like about half of you picked continue nivolumab and add an anti-diarrheal agent, and then about a quarter to a fifth picked continue nivolumab or hold nivolumab and add a steroid. So we'll talk about that. So a grade 1 would be increase of less than 4 stools per day over baseline. And so for grade 1, we could continue and support the patient with an antidiarrheal such as loperamide. It's really when we start into grade 2 where we would start holding the drug and initiating corticosteroids. You do have to be careful, though, because it can progress very quickly from grade 1 to grade 2. Okay. And I had a patient with some mental health issues who, you know, we reiterated multiple times, but he got confused, came in the next week for his next dose of nivolumab, and was having diarrhea about every hour, at least 10 times a day, and ended up in renal failure, and it was a complete disaster. So it can go south pretty quickly. Okay, so in this case, AB was treated with loperamide, and nivolumab was continued. 1 week later, he presents to the office with diarrhea up to 10 times over the past 24 hours and is found to have renal failure. He's urgently admitted to the hospital. So in this particular situation, what would you recommend to the general medicine team caring for AB in the hospital? Would it be A, administer octreotide at a dose of 1 mg/kg, B, administer prednisone at 0.5 to 1 mg/kg, C, administer Lamotil every 4 hours, or D, administer prednisone at 1 to 2 mg/kg. Okay, and it looks like most people picked the correct answer, which would be to administer prednisone 1 to 2 mg/kg. This is a really significant toxicity, and if somebody requires hospitalization, we usually consider that a grade 4 and would want to administer prednisone at 1 to 2 mg/kg. And then you can start tapering down once the diarrhea starts improving. Okay. So let's move on to our second case, and we're getting to the end here, and then we might have a few minutes left for questions. So our second case is JM, who's a 70-year-old female with metastatic squamous non-small cell lung cancer. She has bone and hepatic involvement, and she developed progressive disease after 3 cycles of paclitaxel and carboplatin. And it's recommended at that point that she begin second-line treatment with nivolumab. Okay, she completes 6 cycles and has stable disease noted on CT. Following the 8th cycle, however, she develops a progressive cough and shortness of breath when walking around her house. She's evaluated by the APRN, who recommends obtaining a new chest CT, worried about disease progression. And the chest CT shows patchy infiltrates consistent with an inflammatory process. think this might be our last question. So what would the advanced practitioner recommend at this point for JM? Continue nivolumab and begin prednisone, 1 to 2 mg per kg. B, hold nivolumab and begin prednisone, 1 to 2 mg per kg. C, permanently discontinue nivolumab and begin prednisone, 1 to 2 mg per kg. Or D, continue nivolumab and begin levofloxacin for presumed pneumonia. Okay, so it looks like most people picked hold nivolumab and begin prednisone, 1 to 2 mg per kg. This would typically be considered a grade 2, which means the patient is symptomatic and intervention is indicated. It's impacting their ADLs. So for grade 2, you typically would hold and start steroids. And in this case, you may be able to go back to the nivolumab once the symptoms have resolved and the patient's able to be off prednisone. So it's very individualized. And I think that's my last slide. These are my references. And I think we have some time for some questions. Oh, I'm not sure that I've ever seen anybody. The question is, how often have I seen somebody getting nivolumab have fevers within the first 6 hours? And I have not had any patients report either with nivolumab or pembrolizumab that they've had a fever. I've had some patients say they felt fatigued for a couple of days afterwards.
Quick question regarding the pseudoprogression. So symptomatically, do they seem clinically fine, but the picture doesn't match with how they feel, or are you concerned because they seem like they're progressing?
Right. Yeah, in most cases, they're asymptomatic, but it gets tricky when they develop symptoms. Because sometimes that still could be pseudoprogression. And do you wait it out while they're symptomatic and wait another 4 to 6 weeks and repeat a scan and see if they're getting even worse? I think it really depends on the clinical scenario. We had a patient once who was had progression in her endobronchial disease, and we just did not feel that we could wait and ended up starting her on radiation because things were progressing. But in a lot of cases, they're asymptomatic, and we're able to wait another 4 to 6 weeks and recheck a scan. Do we ever do concurrent radiation with Opdivo? We have more for palliate, like if somebody's getting, palliative radiation to the brain or a bone mets. We have a clinical trial looking at the combination as sort of a RADVAX phenomenon, but outside of a clinical trial, we wouldn't really do like concurrent radiation, thoracic radiation with immunotherapy for curative intent. So it's more until that clinical trial data is available.
How are you?
You're not going to heckle me, are you?
No, I'm not. So when you have the patients that have their changes in their thyroid function, I personally don't like to get involved with that because it's not my area of expertise.
Right.
Do you commonly refer those patients out to go back to their endocrinologist, or do you take that on yourself?
I refer as much as I can because I have not done primary care in a long time. Every once in a while, we have a couple of patients who really don't see their primary care provider, and in those cases, we'll do it for them. But in most cases, we send them back. Just like if they get hyperglycemic on for something we've done, I usually try to refer them back. I just can't keep track of all of the new anti-diabetic medications that are out there. But that's probably more of an individual decision. Yes? We don't. So the question is, if somebody has COPD exacerbation and they're on steroids, do you have to wait until that taper is finished before resuming? And we haven't. There is some controversy as to whether or not those corticosteroids could be counteracting the way these drugs work, but we have not wanted to withhold therapy altogether, so we've kept going. We have a lot of patients that end up on steroids for one reason or another. It's a lung cancer population. And so we have kept going. And I believe there is some preliminary data that perhaps the concomitant steroids aren't as bad as we kind of initially thought. So that's what we do.
What's a typical imaging schedule you use for these patients?
So what we've been doing, because we know that the median time to response isn't until about a little over 2 months, we are waiting until at least 8 to 12 weeks before scanning, and more like 12 weeks, as long as the patients are not clinically showing signs of progression. That way, we're not getting into a situation where we could be seeing a pseudoprogression early on in the treatment course. There's no right or wrong answer, I don't think. And in the clinical trials that we've conducted, a lot of times they get their first scan at 6 to 8 weeks, and then if there's evidence of pseudoprogression, repeating it 4 weeks thereafter. But in the clinical arena, we're really waiting. Plus, a lot of times these patients don't have that many other treatment options beyond immunotherapy because it's already second or third line for them. And so, you know, what are we going to do at that point anyway? So there's another interesting question. A patient had lymph nodes that were enlarged and they got red blotchy circles around them. And have I seen that? I have not. I've had a couple of patients rarely get a mild rash, but that's really rare. I think I've only had maybe two patients on immunotherapy, several different kinds, develop a rash. That can happen, and it's reported in the literature, but in my practice, it's been very rare.
This concludes this podcast from the 2015 Jad Pro Live at AppSHO Conference. To view these slides and claim your educational credit, or to view other programs from this meeting, please visit education.annenberg.net/JadProLive2015.